From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, and yes, we're still on break with Radio West, but we're still doing our film series, which means today in the program, we're talking with filmmakers Tyler Meesom and Patrick Waldrop about their documentary about, wait for it, MTV. The film is about the beginnings of this idea that almost no one thought would work, a channel devoted to music. But it did work, of course. It took off. It became such a powerful influence on art and popular culture. And music videos on TV these days seems dated, but for those of us in an older generation, the nostalgia that you're going to feel watching this film is almost embarrassing. We'll be right back.
KUER is listener-supported public radio, and our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we don't mean to throw you off, those of you who know the show is actually on hiatus for the summer, but we did say we'd check in from time to time, and this is one of those times. We're still doing our film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. And so today we're back talking about Patrick Waldrop and Tyler Meesom's documentary, which we're going to be screening on Wednesday at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. The film, which premiered last month at the Tribeca Film Festival, is about MTV. It's called I Want My MTV, and it's sort of a biopic. They start from the beginning, the very beginning, in 1981, when the first music video they played in those first moments was, appropriately, Video Killed the Radio Star by the Buggles. And lots of people said they remember that, but they probably didn't. Because at that actual moment, hardly anyone was watching. And since cable was still mostly a novelty, most people couldn't watch it. But as the film shows, MTV struck a nerve, and it took off, and it had, still has, a powerful influence on pop culture. So today in the program, we're talking about the film with Tyler Meesom. He co-directed and co-wrote it along with Patrick Waldrop. You can see it Wednesday evening when we're going to be screening it as part of our Through the Lens series. This is our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. The documentary explores the social and popular influence of MTV, but for Patrick Waldrop, a lot of this was personal.
I think that MTV is one of those things that is an individual story for everybody. Yeah. Everybody has a personal relationship with MTV. And yet that's universal because we're talking about everybody. So we're talking about like a big social concept. It's also one of those things that leans itself to great archival and an endless amount of archival. And it ended up being a really big complication, actually.
I bet.
And it's one of those things that it just connects to a very human element and also my childhood obsession with music videos and this love I had for MTV as a kid, really. So I thought it was a way in to American culture, global culture at some point later in it, and that this was a way to show people an experience they all went through that changed them. We all changed with media, and MTV was the innovation engine for that change from 81 to 93, basically. Yep. And then the internet came in.
So it sounds like, aside from the broad themes, which we'll talk about, like the influence it had on culture, the influence it had on just filmmaking and visuals and imagery, we'll talk about that. But for you, it sounds like it was kind of just started personal. It was personal in some ways.
It hits on a real personal level, and then it hits on a big, like, I could talk to anybody about this, or I could have a really intimate conversation about this. Yeah.
Tyler, what about you?
Well, Patrick had started the project. And he'd done a number of interviews, and then he brought me in, and he said, "I want to do a documentary about MTV." And I was raised, in Pleasant Grove, in Manila, it was called, and there was no cable. I went through the '80s without MTV. I just wasn't able to watch it,
right,
other than sneaking it in when I could see it here and there. So I thought about it for a long time. And then I read the book, read a couple of books about it, and I realized, like, this is the consummate. I love rock and roll. Mm-hmm. I love rock and roll stories. I could listen to them all day. And in many ways, this is the consummate rock and roll story of how rock and roll was changed, in addition to the many people who were on MTV. So I said, yeah, let's do it. And that was
– That was fall of 2014.
Right. Wow. So yeah. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually not abnormal for a documentary.
No, I was going to say that. Well, yeah. Big deal. That happens all the time. So someone says in the film early on that MTV, this is how he puts it, dropped a grenade on into the world, basically, on the culture. Talk a little bit about what that means, because, and we'll get back to this, but at its peak, you know, in its prime, how much influence did MTV have really on a certain generation of young people and on popular culture?
It's easy for you and I to know what MTV was. We grew up with it. Those of the 80s who spent their teenage years in the 80s understand that it was everything.
Yeah.
It's how you talked. It's what you listened to. It's how you dressed. It's what you watched every day when you went home from school, and sometimes at 2 in the morning.
Yep.
You put it on when you had a party. You just left it in the corner. Today's generation doesn't really understand how big it was. It is – Doug Herzog, the other day, who's in the film, he said it is Snapchat, YouTube, Facebook, radio, and HBO all put into one. It's everything of today's generation into one. So it was – and it came seemingly for a lot of us out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. It was just one day there wasn't anything to watch, and then the next thing you could watch Cyndi Lauper and Oingo Boingo,
yeah,
and Poison.
It brings up for me the fact that there is such deep nostalgia watching this documentary, seeing those clips, seeing those familiar VJs that we knew so well, some of those really iconic music videos. Iconic! They were like you watched them all. And I can go down the list, and we will talk about some of those later, but... But Patrick, talk a little bit about the nostalgic element, because it's kind of a really... influential part of this.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way anybody who is alive today could watch this and not recognize tons and tons of iconic people and images and just be flooded with memories from their childhood. It doesn't matter if you're in your 70s, you will still know the Beatles. And if you're a kid today, you'll know Sia's videos at the end very well. And what we were doing with the nostalgia is taking a long, cool bath in it, because there's just so much of it that we just embrace it and then thought we need to twist it, because we're looking back at the 80s from a 2019 perspective, and it all looks different. The water is a lot muddier back then. We can see things much clearer now. So while we got to be nostalgic, we also got to look at really meaningful social constructs through this lens, and while also kind of having this fun nostalgic ride.
Yeah. And it's important, we'll talk about this in detail here in a moment, but you didn't back away from the not so glamorous, not so positive parts of MTV, the lack of racial diversity, which you get in a section in the film, the kind of objectification of women and misogyny in a lot of those videos in those days, for example. Talk about how important those elements were too.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that happened with MTV is they built an idea of cool, and then they exported that idea everywhere. And almost immediately what happened was that there was no black people on the network, because their idea of cool was very much based on AOR radio. And AOR radio was album-oriented rock. The other side of radio was R&B. So there was white stations and black stations. MTV came in, they're a visual medium, and people were jarred looking at this all-white-faced musical network.
Yep.
Especially at a time when The Cosby Show was on and the Jeffersons had come on, and there were black performers on other networks, but on MTV.
And if you listen,
but this was the reality of radio at the time, right? Yeah. It was completely segregated.
It was segregated, but the thing is, if you look at music, if you look at pop culture or all of music over the last century, at least half of what's happened that's been great has been minorities.
Right.
And then MTV's on presenting music culture, and it's, you know, a lot of white. There was an actually an ad at the time advertising their diversity because they had the girls and the boys, and to prove it, they had Elvis Costello and Pat Benatar, and it's like
yeah, we're very diverse.
Yeah.
Very diverse.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back to that actually because I want to talk more about that particular moment. I wanted to ask you, one of the things that comes up in the film is how you didn't really have much of, at least in America, a visual representation of a musician or an artist before MTV. This is something that really, I have to say, didn't occur to me until I was looking at the documentary and it's stated like that. I mean, before music videos, and it's almost hard to imagine it now, but most people had perfectly great relationships with their favorite musicians and heroes in music without knowing what they looked like, unless you went to a concert.
Concerts and album covers,
and
occasionally
album
magazines.
Covers. Yeah. But that was about it. Yeah. Yeah. Talk a little bit about the importance of imagery, because this is what MTV seemed to do, at least for American music.
Well, it did. It put the artist, and even if you went to a concert, they were, you know, 200 feet away if you were lucky.
Yeah.
Or if you lived in Pleasant Grove, Utah, you never got to see these artists. So it put them right in your living room, and it made artists think about their image much more. In addition to that, it made artists who looked good. Boy George was unique and interesting and looked interesting. And because of that, Cyndi Lauper, a lot of these artists took advantage of MTV. Conversely, a lot of artists like Chicago and Christopher Cross just didn't really carry that MTV vibe and really wasn't able to grasp onto it. So they kind of faded out.
Yeah, you had to have a sense of image.
Yeah, and some of the artists kicked against it early, like Bruce Springsteen. Mm-hmm. You know, just didn't want to do it.
Yep.
Didn't want to do music videos. His first music videos were they were directed by John Sayles, and they were, you know, New Jersey footage. And then he completely embraced it, buffed up, looked great, and danced with Courtney Cox and became a celebrity and showed his ass
you know,
in front of the American
Absolutely,
flag and became an icon. So it took a while for some artists to adapt, and some just came in right in the gate.
And some never did.
I mean,
Rolling Stones might be the greatest band of all time. They never made a good video.
They didn't.
No, they didn't. No.
It's so interesting. And one of the things that comes up later in the film is that the videos could make you, but they could also break you. The Billy Squier story is pretty interesting.
He had a sold out tour. This terrible video went out. It got closed down. His career ended because of a terrible video.
Yeah, and it is a terrible.
It's
terrible
an unmitigated.
It is hard to keep away from, but it's terrible.
Okay, so let's go back before MTV, just before it.
Was there anything before?
I don't know.
Was there?
Well, there was. And now here's the question: what kind of television was there for you if you were young? I'm not talking about Leave It to Beaver. I'm not talking about All My Sons and the sitcoms. What kind of television was there if you were a young person in the early 1980s, late 1970s?
Well, there was afternoon programming that would be musically based, like American Bandstand and Soul Train.
Soul Train, for sure.
Solid Gold was later in the evening.
And those are all beloved, but the truth is they were never ratings blockbusters.
Right.
And they were meant for young people, and it was almost evidence that this wouldn't work, because if people tried to put music on TV against anything, a B-movie, and it was a Barbra Streisand giant TV special, it would still come in third of three.
And remember, there were only three at the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it wasn't – the idea of music on TV, it was getting shut down everywhere because it wasn't working at the time. Nobody had really found a format to make it work. The music video itself was so new that – the TV industry really didn't know how to look at it even, how to make sense of it. It was the cutting edge of media in a way that it just kind of didn't make sense to them that people would sit down and watch these things.
Yeah.
And remember, early music videos, we don't really see them now anymore, but they weren't that great. It was a very emerging new art form. By and large, the majority of them were bands lip-syncing on a stage. So
that was Bandstand. That's all they did.
Basically, that's
Soul
what
Train
it was.
Too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so that's basically what a lot of the music videos were. So,
promotional in some ways,
right?
Too.
And the music videos were, by and large, they were made by English companies and Australian bands because they couldn't afford to travel to the United States. So they would make these music videos. They'd send them to the U.S. They'd play them in movie theaters. They'd play them late night cable channels, things like that. And so there were some music videos in existence, but because there was a dearth of television for young people, they didn't really have a place to show them.
Who did the first videos, music videos?
Well, that's a tricky question.
Yeah, it is.
The first music videos were actually done by R&B acts in the 20s and 30s. The first music videos that we think of were the Beatles' Hard Day Night videos. Really, when music videos became an institution was when people out of the advertising world and people out of the experimental arts world came together and made videos around music in the mid-70s, Talking Heads, Devo, and one of our subjects is Mike Mothersbaugh from Devo. And then Mike Nesmith was kind of the insider. He'd been in the Monkees. He had a big record contract. He was asked to do a little video like this. And he didn't just sit on a stage and sing the song. He created something that was dreamlike and different than what the record company was expecting. And he wasn't the only one doing this. He was just the only one who was already a big deal on TV. So he kind of moved it forward from there.
Well, Nesmith is interesting. He's an interesting figure because I actually, when one of the reviews for the documentary, this person talked about this moment that you said that Nesmith, the video that he makes for his song Rio, this one reviewer called it the Rosetta Stone of what became MTV. Talk a little bit about that because Nesmith is great. I mean, he's interested in connecting the image with music, right? And he makes that movie, and it's video poetry, he calls it, and it seems different. It seems new.
Well, and Nesmith, of course, had done a lot of music on television before. He was the Monkees.
Yep.
And he'd done a film called Head, which is a very strange – was Head before?
Oh, yeah.
And which is a very strange, unique music mixed with comedy. It's a very interesting film.
It was written by Jack Nicholson, actually wrote it.
No way.
Yeah.
So he'd kind of known this, and he wanted to push the boundaries of things. So he did this music video, Rio, and it was very unique. And he, as he said, and he tells a story to us, and it isn't in the film, unfortunately, because you can't make a 10-hour film like we wanted to do. He talks about being in the editing room, and he had shot all this weird footage of him riding on a horse and him, you know, on the beach and then him dancing and with dancers and all this crazy stuff. And he said he was editing it. And at the time, you'd edit live. You'd have 10 tapes playing at a time. And he said he just started getting this rhythm, and it started to work with the beat of the music. And he talks about that was the moment. That moment is when the music video was essentially born in its fashion as we know it today.
One of the first American iterations of MTV then becomes the show that Nesmith has conceived. It's called Pop Clips. And this brings into the story, this television executive is really important to the story, a guy named John Lack. And when Lack sees Pop Clips, it seems to like change everything for him. So let me play a moment from the documentary. Here it is from I Want My MTV.
Michael came to see me with this little show and it changed my life. It was kind of the first video poetry I ever saw. It wasn't just bands playing their music. I was a journalist running an all-news radio station. All my friends were running rock stations in New York, and I wasn't having the fun they were having. This was my chance.
He said, you could put on like a whole music television channel. And I said, yeah.
How important was this moment for the story of MTV, Lack coming in contact with this idea?
Well, Lack was on his honeymoon a few months before that, and he was in Japan. And on a pay-per-view channel, a weird channel playing in the hotel, he watched these music videos, and that stuck in his head. And of course, he came from music. He loved music. He was from New York City. He'd grown up listening to music. And so that was something he was looking for and trying to get on the air. He worked at Warner Amex. He worked for Warner, and he was essentially in charge of the early days of cable. There were, of course, very few cable channels on at the time. There was HBO. There was the Movie Channel, ESPN, the Weather Channel.
This was a radical experiment, right? Actually, at the time. It was Warner Amex Cable Company had Nickelodeon and the Movie Channel. And the third thing they were going to do, they wanted to do a bunch of channels. They wanted like different lifestyle channels. And the third thing was he was trying to sell them on video radio, rock and roll radio on TV. This was his like mission in life after he saw these videos.
So when he saw that Michael Nesmith had collected a lot of these and was doing this, he said, let's do this together. Let's put this on. And not to spoil too much of the movie, but he said, Michael, come do this with me. Come do this. And Nesmith said, I don't want to be a television executive. I don't want to move to New York. I have a ranch in California. Now, Michael Nesmith's mother had invented Whiteout. And
so
had
he
made
was fine.
Millions of dollars. Yeah. And then she passed away. So basically passed on all of these millions of dollars to Michael Nesmith, who really just was pretty happy doing silly videos.
And was already a great
Carmel.
TV star.
Yeah, for sure. But he did some really great TV. Like, I don't know if you remember Television Parts.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Such a great.
Elephant Parts.
There's fragments of it in the movie.
Yeah. So he's terrific. But I have to, when you talked to him, did he at all express any regret that he didn't get on involved in the ground floor of MTV?
Well, he was involved in the ground floor.
Sure.
They gave him good money. He produced a show he wanted to produce, and he got to walk away. And truthfully, I think he's really happy he walked away when he did, because this other team of young, you know, these guys were all 22 to 26 year old, super aggressive TV executives come in and run MTV.
Yeah.
And he wasn't going to be a part of that. He was, you know, he was in his late 30s by this point. He'd already been around, and he had his own production company doing, you know, he's doing Jacques Cousteau documentaries at the time.
Yeah. And I asked him point blank, do you regret it? And without hesitation, no, not at all. Not one. He meant it. He had no regrets about not really being known for starting one of the greatest cultural events in all of American history.
This is an important part I wanted to ask you about. And it gets to what you were saying about John Lack and his commitment to, and all the other executives, or many of them anyway, their commitment to music. And this comes up early in the film, the musician and artist Jack Antonoff, who he's with the Bleachers and the band Bleachers and Fun. And he says something really early on. I want to play this and I want to talk about it. Here's another moment from the film.
This is an interesting concept. I think people do amazing things in the name of making it. Or you could call that getting rich. Well, the only reason why I say getting rich is because this point is going to be about money. I think people do amazing things to get wherever they think they're going to go. They make great records. They make brilliant television networks like MTV. I don't believe anyone started MTV to make money. I don't believe it. And I think if they were here, they'd tell you that.
You think that's true? Do you believe that?
Yes. And they all did say exactly that. In the end, they made choices about money in the name of, shareholders and corporate agendas, but when it was starting, they couldn't have cared less. They were on a mission that was just – every one of them was so intensely – they were zealots for this idea. So they couldn't have cared less at the time. Now, once they'd built their empire, then they cared.
Then it mattered.
Yeah.
But you know what it made me think about is it seems like – and again, maybe I'm over-sentimentalizing it, but – it seems like it represents a different motivation from a different time. Like, it seems like right now in an era of startups and, you know, people striving to become billionaires, that money wasn't necessarily a factor for them at first. And that seems different in some ways culturally.
Well, I mean, you can create an app or a business now and you know you're going to make millions of dollars. At the time, this was cable television.
Yeah.
Very few people in the United States had it. They didn't think it was going to be in every home in the world. They had no idea at the time. Also, mind you, it's easy for us to look back and say, oh, music on television. Well, of course that's going to work. Why wouldn't it work? But at the time, nobody believed that this silly little network would work. There were very few music videos in existence. Nobody had or cable. Nobody wanted to do these. The record labels didn't care about it.
The insanity of their plan is it actually meant that they needed record labels to start making videos, spending a lot of money on it, and giving it to them for free.
Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
There was no incentive for – so they all said no at first.
Oh, yeah.
Almost.
Well, no one was watching cable in those days.
Yeah, of course.
No.
Yeah.
And if they were watching cable – there wasn't such thing as TV for teenagers. That's one of the things that MTV really changed in its own right, is there'd never been a network aimed at teenagers, not let alone here, but anywhere. And then 10 years later, there was one everywhere.
Yeah. It's kind of like that Will Ferrell joke when he's wrong Burgundy and he does that ESPN bit where he's pretending like it's before ESPN and he says, this will never – 24-hour sports, that's a ridiculous idea. That will never work.
Right.
It's the same thing. Back then, most executives were like, that is a horrible, stupid idea.
Yeah.
No one really knew it was coming.
I think they had Saturday Night Live. of course. That was, if there was one show that definitely said, we are appealing to a counterculture and youth generation, this is it. So in many ways, that was able to pave the way for them, that kids will watch television, especially in the middle of the day. Hell, you remember middle of the day television for summer vacation? There was game shows and soap operas.
Yep.
That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were looking at Nickelodeon as evidence that MTV would be a smart move because of the they could get Pepsi and Clarisale to buy a lot of ads. Yeah.
Yeah. So these guys start, they make the pitch. They're able to get the first 25 mil, which doesn't seem like a lot, and it probably wasn't even a lot then, but they have enough to get started. And they want, I want to talk about August 1st, 1981. This is the day MTV actually launches. And they want this big set piece. This is what you talk about in the documentary, to launch the channel. They're thinking about these monumental moments in television history, and what they end up with is the moonshot, you know, the moon landing. So, but for the launch, the executives and the people who had conceived all of this, they couldn't actually watch it launch from their offices in New York City. You couldn't get cable in New York City in those days. So just talk about this story, because they have to basically take a bus to New Jersey.
Yeah. So most of the country didn't have cable in 1981.
Right.
And Manhattan did have cable, but it was a very limited cable access system, and it was very New York-centric, and they didn't carry MTV for another 18 months. So they have to drive in a Yellowbird bus. They jump in to Fort Lee, New Jersey, to get into this dive bar restaurant's basement and watch a little TV stand. And then there was technical issues that night. Andy Sidos, who's one of the brilliant engineers in television history, was frantic that night trying to hold it all together, and it didn't hold together. So part of it, you know, it went off air in its second video and came back on. Everyone's panicked. Everyone's elated. There's a real strong atmosphere of how passionate these guys were.
That comes through in this clip I want to play, actually, because remember that first iconic video that plays, and it's perfect. It's like it was almost built for MTV. Right. It's the Buggles, Video Killed the Radio Star. Here's a moment. We'll hear and hear John Lack and some of the VJs, Mark Goodman and Alan Hunter, just the excitement of that first day there and that dumpy basement trying to watch the beginning of MTV.
And of course, the first famous song, Video Killed the Radio Star, which was the ideal for song.
It was a really huge moment when that rocket launched. I cried, which surprised me.
Whenever I hear the Buggles intro to Video Kill the Radio Star, I get goosebumps. I get emotional.
It was like birthing a child for me. It was very personal and very exciting, and all I was doing was hugging people and crying. My greatest MTV moment had to be that night in that little dingy bar where nobody was watching but us.
Everybody in the room felt like we were doing something really cool, like we were all together in this.
Then the signal's dead.
Sometime
after it. I mean, it was a little sketchy at first.
Yeah.
But you can tell the passion of these guys in those early days when no one really knows what's out there yet.
You know, they think they're about to unveil the biggest secret in the world and that the world's about to erupt as soon as this goes out. And nothing happens at first. Just nothing at all.
Despite everyone I run into saying that they watched it that first night.
Everyone says
a lot of people were at Woodstock as well.
Yeah,
Doug,
that's right.
Cable was in very few places in the United States. And if they lived in a small town, they may have. I know that it was in Orem. It was in Mountain Home, Idaho. Mm-hmm. So there are people that may or may have
if they
not
lived,
watched
if they
it,
lived but, in rural Michigan or Ohio, right. They probably were – and they were a certain age. They're probably telling the truth. But the thing is, it wasn't even advertised.
Yeah.
Nobody even knew it was going to go up. So it's not like there was the buzz of it.
Yeah.
That came later.
It's
yeah.
true. It seems like one of the things that comes through in the film is, while American musicians hadn't figured out music videos, the Brits did. They got this before the Americans did. Visual imagery had been important to their music long before the Americans had. Talk a little bit about this part, because this is a, as Billy Idol says in this clip we'll play in a moment, it was this kind of second British invasion that plays out.
Yeah, well, like I said, they had been doing music videos because they were shipping them, exporting them to the United States. And they also had a lot of shows, Old Grey Whistle Test and Top of the Pops.
Right.
So they had created these like pseudo music videos. And so when MTV, seeking content, because they were so few music videos, so bands from New Zealand, bands from Australia, bands from England shipped their content over here, and the Police and Duran Duran. But then smaller bands like Meesex and, you know, these really quirky bands that should never have had airplay in the United States suddenly were being played in Wisconsin.
Because they had a video.
Because they had a video.
Yeah. Well, here's Billy Idol. We'll also hear Sting in this clip from the documentary.
Punk rock was about the bands creating themselves, and we brought that punk rock attitude into MTV.
So MTV are, you know, seeking product, and there it is, the British artists have it.
Of course, we'd grown up with visual imagery being a part of music, watching film clips on Top of the Pops.
Top of the Pops every Thursday night. To get on the show, you had to be in the top 20.
Doing a song which you basically would do a short form video for. For Dancing With Myself, I was very much involved in the ideas. It was very important that we, the artists, were saying what our imagery was going to be.
It's really boring when people just show a disco and people dancing in mirrors or something. I mean, I ain't gonna do that.
This was us creating ourselves. It was very much a second British invasion, spearheaded through MTV.
This is so interesting, the way videos changed the way artists approached their music, because now it wasn't just the music that was important. And it's interesting, you have the Eurythmics on in the documentary. You interview Annie Lennox and Dave Stewart, and they're talking about how it became an important element of the artistry of the musicians. It wasn't just about the music, it was about other things too, and that was the sort of the image. And the fact that they directed these things, they helped shoot these things. They, as Annie Lennox, or I think Dave Stewart said, they even dealt with makeup and lighting and all of those things.
One of the things that was really interesting and was really a discovery along the way is how complex and different each artist's relationship with MTV was. Hmm. The Eurythmics or Talking Heads or Devo, those are the kinds of bands that were just – they dove headfirst into video as part of the artistic form for them. They loved doing this from the get-go, and they weren't – to them, image was art.
Yeah.
There's other bands – you know, Bruce Springsteen hated being a part of this image thing. He wanted to – you know, an album cover was plenty image for him.
Poor REO Speedwagon too, right?
And then some people just – frankly – you can't get it right, it seems. Yeah. And REO Speedwagon is like the most lovely person and very enjoyable.
And a great band. Great music.
Totally.
Still,
like,
but they were so honest to you guys in talking about the fact that we never got this right.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, he just made fun of his own videos and talked about how painful it is to still see them.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to ask you about, we were talking earlier about one of the real controversies that shaped MTV in those early days, and that was the fact that they were not playing very many black artists. And I have to say, guys, it was interesting how defensive some of those executives still are about that era. Did you notice that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I mean, look, race is a very touchy topic. And a lot of these guys who started MTV, they came from radio. And they were white radio. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these guys actually came from the South. The guys who started MTV were Alabama. So, you know, you bring in race from someone with the South and you accuse them of that. It's always going to be touchy and difficult.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that MTV showed very few to zero black artists for a long period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, which was just conspicuous. And there's a moment, I want to play a section from it because it's included here in the documentary. It's become, I think, for a lot of people, kind of an iconic interview. This is with the VJ Mark Goodman and David Bowie.
Yeah.
Where Bowie is mystified by the fact that American MTV is not playing more black artists. Set this up for us, this moment, because it's really
interesting. Well, I think David Bowie gives a little bit of a masterclass in public discourse here. And he's very cool, but he's challenging to Mark Goodman, who's, you know, he's essentially in the scene. He's in his mid-20s, and he's kind of a mouthpiece for a large media corporation that is trying to figure itself out. They don't know what they're doing, and now they know they don't know what they're doing, but they don't know how to fix it. And that's when David Bowie kind of pushed back and started asking questions of Mark Goodman during an interview, and it got heated a little bit, and it got a little bit it's tense.
It occurred to me, having watched MTV over the last few months, that there's so few black artists featured on it. Why is that?
We want to play artists that seem to be doing music that fits into what we want to play for MTV.
But there seem to be a lot of black artists making very good videos that I'm surprised aren't used on MTV.
What I attempted to do was to explain programming was based on a very accepted idea of what rock radio was at the time.
We have to play the music that we think an entire country is going to like, and certainly we're a rock and roll station now.
Nobody called any rock radio station into question for not playing black artists.
The Isley Brothers mean something to me, and so do the Spinners. But what does it mean to a 17-year-old? Well, it's
I'll tell you what maybe the Isley Brothers or Marvin Gaye means to a black 17-year-old.
Ah.
And surely he's part of America as well.
No question. And that's, of course, also we have to try and do what we think not only New York and Los Angeles will appreciate, but also Poughkeepsie or Midwest, pick some town in the Midwest that will be scared to death by Prince, which we're playing, or a string of other black faces.
That's
and black
very
music.
Interesting. Isn't that interesting?
Poor Mark Goodman. And he does confess he regrets that. I mean, he kept digging.
It's painful and frustrating. Painful. He didn't love that we had this. We had some exchange in the movie. He didn't really want us to put this in there, frankly.
Yeah,
but
of course,
you have to.
We had to, and he understood. And it's awkward. It's painful for him. But
hey, you do dopey things
it.
When you're young. Yeah. And that was a dumb thing to say.
But here's Mark, and he's like, I'm interviewing David Bowie. I love David Bowie, and we're talking about his new album. And then David Bowie is like, hey, you, VJ, speak for an entire network.
Yep.
You're just an on-camera presence. So be polite to David Bowie, but also the network executives are watching you as well, and he's just stuck in the middle, sucker punched, and you do feel awful.
You could see it on his face at the end of the interview of like, oh.
Yeah. Oh, it was awful. It was wince-inducing.
And MTV never aired that. That was a kind of an outtake, and they released it only on the internet, about 6 years ago?
When David Bowie died, a bunch of cool stuff about David Bowie went out, and that was interview one part.
But to their credit, they finally did. And, 30 years later or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But it does bring us, as you were saying, Patrick, to that sort of another icon. And they start courting Michael Jackson. Yeah. And how crucial is Michael Jackson to the story of MTV?
Michael Jackson made MTV in a way that was bigger than the I Want My MTV campaign, which changed the game for him,
yep.
or any other event. It's the biggest event in MTV was actually Billie Jean, when they didn't want Billie Jean because it's an R&B song. And
it's not quote-unquote rock and roll.
Beat It had Eddie Van Halen guitar lick.
So
they wanted to run with that one, and they got tricked into doing Billie Jean, and it became a phenomenon, and it kind of broke the color barrier on radio as well. It had such a resounding effect. The combination of the videos off the Thriller album in general had such an effect that it really broke down all of those barriers.
And look, Billie Jean's a great song, but it's also a great video. I mean, it still holds up really well. And at that time when it came out, that was a groundbreaking video visually.
What was it like interviewing people like Billy Idol and Sting and Annie Lennox? I mean, that must have been – let's be honest. That must have been such a treat. To talk to them.
I wish I could have called my 15-year-old self and said, you won't believe who I'm going to see Billy Idol. But they're there to do a job, and we're there to do a job.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to meet your idols and to talk to them, but they are there to say things right, and they're very conscious of what they say and how they say it and mm-hmm. what they appear. And a lot of them, while a lot of the artists – made their existence because of the 80s, you know, they don't want to talk about the high school days.
Yeah, glory days.
Right.
Yeah.
But many of them did. Many of them did. And many of them recognize and realize that without MTV, they may not be interviewed right now anyway. So,
how important was Madonna to MTV?
Michael Jackson, Madonna, and Nirvana are the three acts that had a special relationship with MTV, where MTV would do anything for them and they would do anything for MTV. And they really took care of each other. And Madonna was the most aggressive of any of them. She was the most take charge. And so they had a very cozy relationship. And, you know, in the movie, what you'll see is a bunch of kids impersonating Madonna and then a bunch of rock stars saying, oh, we had to start worrying about our image now.
Yeah.
But Madonna was one of those who was, I mean, she was kind of raised on MTV just a bit. She was able, unlike David Bowie, who came, you know, had a career prior to MTV, she did not have a career. And she realized and recognized, if I look good and look sexy, I can be an MTV icon.
One of the themes that comes through in the film, I think, is how MTV... this is how it's put in the doc by someone, opened the world to young people, getting to see people they had never seen in different places. Tyler Glenn of Neon Trees is there in the film. He talks about how it was the first time he'd ever seen gay people who were able to be themselves in a way, called it a portal to the outside world. And there's this moment with the entertainment and music journalist Lindsay Parker I wanted to play, because she talks about just the importance of seeing people being willing to be rebels and be themselves. It was really important for youth culture at the time. Here's Lindsay Parker from the documentary.
Bands like Human League, Thompson Twins, Bananarama with their huge hair, Culture Club. Is that a man? Is that a woman? I want that makeup. I want that tunic with the Hebrew letters on it. We'd never seen anything like it in our life. It was cool for guys to wear makeup. It was okay to be androgynous. Boys who wore eyeliner and were skinny and looked like they'd get their ass kicked at school. Robert Smith with this fright wig of hair, can't even get his lipstick on right. Adam Ant dressed like a pirate because of MTV. The weirdos were the stars.
How important is that to this story? The fact that kind of the misfits now had a place. They became stars in some ways.
You know, who immediately benefits from something like MTV is a performer like Cyndi Lauper, who has an outrageous personality. There's something almost cartoonish, but there's also something genuine and poetic about what she does. That was a perfect pairing. And why it is because somebody's exploring identity and somebody's exploding that identity to its biggest form of itself. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing that you see, you know, with Karma Chameleon. Any of the videos, the Adam Ant video they're just talking about, they're all very explosive, outrageous personalities that were really entertaining. But what was happening underneath that is it was beginning to normalize weirdos, as they would put it, the others, or queer lifestyles.
Yeah.
And today it's easy. You know, kids can find the other people who like their same kind of music, who like their same kind of dress. But in the 80s, if you liked odd music or you liked to dress weird or you were gay, you didn't know. You had no one else. And then all of a sudden on your television, there's somebody who dresses like you or looks like you. And then you could go to school and say, hey, you like Culture Club as well. We should hang out.
Well, within a mile of here, there's somebody with pink hair.
Yeah.
You know, and
not even that far, dude.
Yeah. And the thing is, that didn't exist before this phenomenon you're talking about right now.
Yeah.
Because it became normal to go ahead and dye your hair pink and go to school or go to work like that.
Yeah. Patrick Waldrop, along with Tyler Meesom, he directed and wrote the documentary film I Want My MTV, which we're going to be screening on Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center at 7 o'clock. Tyler is going to be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Hi, podcast listeners. So you probably know we also make short films, and so I just wanted to get you to watch our latest. It's about a U.S. Army soldier, Alyssa Peterson. She conducted interrogations during the most intense moments of the fighting in Iraq, and in 2003, she died by suicide. The film is the story of her brother Mitch, who wanted to learn what he could about her death. He told us he owed it to her. The film is called Casualties. Go see it at RadioWest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmakers Tyler Meesom and Patrick Waldrop. We're talking about the documentary I Want My MTV, which we're going to be screening on Wednesday at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. I'm surprised at, and because I hadn't really put two and two together about the timing of all of this, how it burst onto the scene and then starts to play out pretty quickly. Like, the music videos really ran their course in 12 years in some ways, maybe a little bit longer. I mean, things start to change. And I wanted to talk about how MTV, you don't get into this a lot, but what's relevant about MTV today when there's YouTube and other things?
Well, there's nothing relevant about playing music videos on cable. As soon as Napster happened, I started downloading my music videos. I never watched MTV again. I was like 19 at the time.
Yeah.
But, MTV is meant for 12 to 19-year-olds, and they do very well with them, and they hope to keep people until they're 24. But the truth is, sometime between 19 and 24, you're going to lose interest in MTV because it's not meant for you.
Yeah.
So that relevance changes. But nobody was ever going to wait around to watch a music video again, which was such a staple of it. They needed you to sit through three or four videos you maybe didn't want to watch and at least one set of commercials to see that one video you're dying to see. And as soon as the internet happened—
Forget it. Never.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So YouTube is the way music videos, I think, want to be seen and distributed. I think it really works well for the format itself.
But you talk about how MTV had to change. How, of course, and you go through, all of these different eras. One of them is when Viacom buys MTV and the rug comes out from under it, starts to change. They're looking for more revenue. And so and we should also mention, we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but MTV is where the birth of reality television comes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when MTV first launched, the music video was so unique and it was such a unique art form that every music video was amazing. And then after a while, they started to be the same and nobody wanted to watch them and nobody wanted to wait through an Oingo Boingo video to watch Warrant. Or the other way around.
Or Sheila E.
Whatever it may be. So they just started tuning out. And I don't want to watch MTV all the time, and I'll tune to it once in a while. If there's one thing that MTV did is they embraced change. And unlike other networks, they would shift very quickly. And they would throw ideas against the wall. And if it worked, they stayed with it. If it didn't work, they'd move on and try something else. And they operated from very low budget. They would just try things. Versus ABC, which would have a $1 million pilot and put it on the air and do test groups. They just try something. And for a while, MTV was suffering. People weren't watching music videos. Music videos were stale. Nobody cared anymore.
If you had a year with Michael Jackson, Madonna videos, it was golden. But if you didn't,
you
1988 was actually a pretty bummer year at MTV. They suddenly look and realize, oh, no.
So they said, we want to do some kind of – they'd done game shows, so remote control, and they'd done a few different kind of shows. But somebody said, why don't we do a soap opera with kids? And they put together the budget, and they said, we can't afford actors and sets and locations. We're not going to do that.
That's not how they work. They don't pay.
Yeah. We don't pay people. We get music videos for free. And then somebody had this light bulb idea and said, why don't we just put real kids in a house – and follow them. And at the time, there was very few reality TV. The only really one was American Family, which had shown on PBS. That was really the only unscripted show ever outside of like Queen for a Day and things like that.
Yeah.
And it launched and immediately just blew any music video. Their ratings went through the roof.
Yeah, tripled. I think somebody mentioned tripled the ratings.
And it never let down.
It went up from there. Yeah, skyrocketed. And it's what they became known for.
Let me ask you this finally, because it's interesting to see how, while there aren't any music videos on MTV anymore, it's different.
They do have multiple music video channels. This is something a lot of people don't know.
Oh, yeah, because there are various other.
Dial in close enough, they have three or four different channels. And the main one doesn't play videos because it doesn't make any sense anymore.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
But what I mean is I just think it's interesting to see the people kind of like you who grew up on MTV and – well, all of you who grew up on MTV, how it changed your approach to art and culture. That seems to be coming through. And I have to say, the document, I won't give anything away towards the end, but it's a pretty hopeful end that you guys come up with. Say something about that.
I go back to my imagination being just ignited, seeing something like Don't Come Around Here No More, or, you know, the Cars video for You Might Think. Just these really imaginative, subversive, surrealistic videos.
Yeah. Take me on.
They're really inspiring to me as a kid. So a lot of my imagination and curiosity, I attribute it to MTV in that childhood experience. And I love it. I have such a loving feeling for it. And there's a thing of, let's all get into this. Let's all have this Wonderland-esque conversation. And I love music video. So the idea is, we're all still in this. Like, this is an ongoing conversation with a lot of bumps. Like, let's keep going through the bumps together. At the end, there's a couple great statements, and one of them's Norman Lear, and he's saying, if the world is to be healed, it's because we will be laughing and dancing together. It'll be through the arts bringing us together. And I think that's true.
And while the film is about MTV, it's more about kind of the evolution of the music video and this new art form that artists would create themselves. Almost got way too large, and it used to be just small artists creating these small little videos for fun, and then it became multi-million-dollar videos controlled by the record labels, and it lost the artistic touch, and became stale.
It is rarely about creativity in those ones.
Yeah, and now we're seeing this resurgence because of YouTube and because of the accessibility of cameras and editing systems, where artists are making their own music videos, and you can put a music video up and have twice the reach that you could on MTV.
Yeah.
Instantly, like that. So the music videos we're seeing now, and not just the huge ones that still exist from Beyonce and Kanye West, but we're seeing these small bands make their little music videos and instantly get recognized in Africa.
We interview OK Go, and they're like the Duran Duran of YouTube, because they're the first YouTube video sensation. And it's almost insane to think of a time when, there was no such thing as music videos on MTV, and nobody would have thought to share a video with somebody in Japan. That just wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. It's evolved so quickly and so differently than anyone would have imagined, but I think it's great. I think we're in a really great environment for it.
Patrick Waldrop, he and Tyler Meesom directed and wrote the documentary film I Want My MTV, which we're going to be screening on Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. It begins at 7 o'clock. Tyler Meesom will be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.